great sort of joys of this study is it's not a study of sort of abstract guilt-producing principles. It's rather a really helpful way to be able to look into the stuff that makes you, you. In other words, you're getting a glimpse, as it were, of the manufacturer's design for your life. So what are the kind of things that we found about you? Well, we've learned that you are a heart that is that motivates everything that you do. We have learned that you're someone who needs authority, a word from the outside instead of a graven image to guide you by. We've learned that there is a necessity of this God to maintain his reputation for his people. We've learned that you need rest, that you're built to be a resting person. We've learned that there is authority that you need to respond to, whether it be father and mother or civil servant. We've learned that the preservation of life is a basic fundamental human instinct. We learned that your sexuality is a powerful aspect of what motivates you in all kinds of things. We learned last week that you are a person who is given to be a steward over some stuff. Your stuff is important. It goes down to the core of your being. Well, today what we're going to learn is this final aspect of yourself that is truly, truly powerful is the idea of your words. The idea of your words. And so the commandment says as such, no lying is the very simple word. No bearing false witness, as it turns out. Well, here's what we end up needing to introduce when we start on a commandment like no lying. And that is that we always begin with this question of us being created in the image of God. From all eternity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit have been in a mutual, perfect, eternal fellowship with one another. But one way you can say this is that from the very beginning, God among himself has been communicating. God is a great communicator. He doesn't struggle with communication. He is a great communicator among himself. And we also find that when the time comes for him to create creatures in his image, that he brings something out of nothing. How does he do it? What's the means by which he creates everything there is? By speaking. He uses words to bring about his entire creation. Finally, when God himself shows up in human flesh, John describes his coming as if the Word was dwelling among us. In other words, doesn't it stand to reason that when a God like that in whom we are created in the image of, that our humanity is profoundly shaped by our speaking? It's by our speaking, by our words, by our tongue. And it gets down deeper than oftentimes we would start to believe. It is innate and pervasive, and therefore a huge piece of the puzzle of trying to understand why I am the way I am. A massive key to the question of our manufacturer's design. I think this is what James is getting at in the third chapter of James, James chapter 3, verses 4 and 5. Where James compares the tongue, the words you say, to the rudder of a ship. He's like, look, how many trees of wood go into the construction of a large, sea-bearing vessel? But a relatively tiny piece of wood that we call the rudder can turn the entire thing. And so he says, your tongue, therefore, the words that come out of your mouth, is just as, if I can use this phrase, intra-personally powerful to you as a rudder is to a ship. So much so that the whole direction of your life can be shaped and fashioned by the words that come up out of your mouth. Or, as it turns out, the words that don't come up out of your mouth. So, look, I want this morning to sort of test that claim to see if the tongue can bear that kind of weight and whether or not our words really are as powerful as the Bible says that they are. And I'm going to, what do you call it when you give the end away? Spoiler alert. I think it is going to bear out that way. I stammered and stammered through that little point, so let's just forget that happened. Okay, the powerful tongue. This is a chameleon with a powerful tongue for the picture. Again, the pictures are just as illustrative as anything else. Back in the old days when we used to surf through television, we called this surfing to high schoolers. You picked up a remote control and you kind of went through station after station. This is before you had a guide that would pop up and you could sort of choose and not have to trace through things. Invariably, you stumbled across, while you were sort of going from channel to channel, something called C-SPAN. C-SPAN, I think, is still on. I think it's still out there. But you never stopped on C-SPAN because it was typically this like very small corner of some library where an author was reading excerpts from, you know, his latest book, and, you know, like 3 seconds of it and your head was about to explode from boredom, so you just couldn't press the next channel. But every now and then it would stop, especially if you got there sort of later in the evening, on a scene from British Parliament. I don't know whether it was House of Commons or House of Lords or whatever else, but I found myself absolutely fascinated by these things because they would basically sit on either sides, and you had these British people that would sit back with these scowls on their faces, and someone would come up and be, it was usually the prime minister that was standing at a lectern defending his ideas to the, you know, just the hurling of abuse that would come at him. Mr. So-and-so, do you dare say that, blah, 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 blah. And they would sort of insult each other in this high British accent. It was wildly entertaining. I actually was, in my study for this, was reading a commentary on the Ten Commandments by a guy I'm going to quote a ton on this lesson, named Colin Smith. He's a pastor somewhere up in the Midwest who published some teaching manuals. And he actually drew out this point that in those British Parliament settings, one of the things, you could say whatever you wanted to about the person, about the candidate's party, about their ideas and their policies, and it was rancorous at best. But you could not use the word liar. Apparently, in sort of British parliamentary decorum, it is absolutely out of bounds to call somebody a liar. Why? Well, because it had been officially deemed, apparently, on the books, as being unparliamentary language. You can't do that. It's one thing to say that someone's views and their opinions and their policies are bad, but to call someone a liar was like the highest possible offense. So that you can't say that in British Parliament, of all things. Well, why? Well, because the tongue is a source of amazing power. Keller was the first one I heard say, I've heard other people say it since, that one of the greatest travesties that was ever foisted upon our childhoods is the little phrase, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me, right? Keller says that's the biggest lie ever foisted upon children because it's utter and completely false. The Bible actually has a completely opposite view. It takes our words incredibly seriously. Proverbs 18:21 is one of the most dramatic. Death and life are in the power of the tongue. Death and life. And those who love it will eat its fruits. Jesus says in Matthew 12 that every human being, when all of the sort of books are opened and the, you know, judgment is being doled out, every human being will be given account for every idle word. Every idle word will be listed. Let me see if we can sort of illustrate this. I remember being fascinated by the story when I was a child of Jacob and Esau. You remember Jacob and Esau were brothers. They were very different sort of people. Esau was this sort of outdoorsy, mannish type dude. Jacob was a little bit, a little bit more feminine and it was connected with mommy a little bit too much, probably. Well, there's this one story where Jacob is cooking up some stew, and Esau comes in just absolutely famished. And through a little set of circumstances, Esau ends up selling to Jacob his privileged rights that he has as being the oldest son, okay? Which was incredibly flippant and pretty irresponsible on Esau's part. But as the story goes on many years later, when their father Isaac is about to die, Jacob actually tricks Esau into getting the blessing from his father. And so the story goes that Jacob dresses up with the help of mama. Rebecca's all in on this. Dresses up like Esau. He puts, like, you know, hair on his arms so that his father knows he's got hairy arms. And he puts on some of Esau's clothing so that he smells like Esau. And he comes in. And Isaac's blind. He doesn't know what's going on. And Isaac pronounces this blessing over who he thinks is Esau, but is actually Jacob. Okay? Puts his hand on his head. I say, he gives all these promises about what he's going to be. Well, then he goes out. Well, not 5 minutes later, Esau comes back in. And is like, Father, I've come back in to receive the blessing. And Isaac is like, who are you? I just gave you the blessing. You were just here. And he's like, no, I wasn't here. And Isaac immediately understands. He's like, your brother has tricked you out of your blessing as the oldest person. And all of a sudden, Esau is like, oh, please, please. You know, is there no blessing left for me? And Jacob or Isaac ends up giving him a pretty weak sort of milquetoast blessing. Really, it's only a view of impending judgment for the poor guy. But I remember reading that story and being like, what in the world? Like, clearly, Isaac and Esau know that Jacob just tricked them. Like, who cares? Why couldn't, you know, Isaac just have stopped and said, oh, wait a minute, blah, 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 reverse, you know, I take that blessing away. Can't you just say that? Why wouldn't he just say that? Well, because in that culture, a word spoken was a weighty thing. It was a weighty thing. And you didn't just step up and say, oh, I changed my mind, in order to sort of deal with someone's, even with someone's treachery in the midst of it. Once your word was spoken in that culture, it was the same as an action. Look, all I'm saying is the Bible teaches that our words are directly connected to our souls in a million different ways. The first thing is we find that our words have power over others. Words can start wars. Words can destroy people by pushing them into suicide. Words have the power to frame someone's personal psychology. The Bible says that words are so central to human experience that you have the power to dehumanize someone with your words. Your words have the ability to rob them of life. You can rob them of an essential component of what it means to live by using dangerous words. Secondly, though, we know that our words have the power over our communities. They can build up or destroy community. I think actually this is probably the original intent of the commandment. It specifically refers to lying under oath while you're in a trial, being in the midst of a trial. And so you see what's being established there is that when there's no truth, you ultimately have no justice. This is one of the reasons why before you get up in a court of law, you have to take that oath before you testify. I make a promise, a public promise, that I'm going to tell the whole truth, the all truth, or nothing but the truth. So help me God, whatever the vow goes. Where there is no truth, there is no justice. Can you imagine a society where there was no sense of repayment for wrongs? Like, that would be chaos, absolute chaos, and detrimental to people's livelihood. And so therefore, they created a rule that said when a culture loses trust in one another, you don't have a culture. You don't have a community. You don't have a society where I can't count on the words that people are saying. A foundation of a civilized society will erode when words are careless or words are false. Okay? Thirdly, and this to me is the most interesting, words, it turns out, also have power over the speaker of the words. Please hear me on this. This is a big deal. It is not just that our words have power over the people to whom we are speaking, but words also have power over you as you speak them. Now, what do I mean by this? Well, I've got a bunch of illustrations that are fun for me to go through. I love these illustrations. In other words, the words that leave your mouth are not just fashioning the environment around you. They are also fashioning you. They are making you into who you are. We typically think that words are just a reflection of what's inside of us, and that certainly is true. But if what James is saying is true, it means that the words affirm, create, and destroy things inside of us as well. Let me see if I can throw out some illustrations here. Have you ever been irritated with someone, so angry at them, that all of a sudden you began to talk to them about your anger towards them, and suddenly you kind of felt it sort of like the temperature was rising in you, and all of a sudden you find yourself saying things that in other normal circumstances you would never say just because it's like, and things are coming out, even things you even regret saying? Why? Well, because once you head down a certain path with words, those words start to come home to you. And what started as an irritation with someone can turn into a little bitty snowball rolling down the hill, and suddenly it's an entire avalanche of crushing words. and you even feel it. Like your emotions get out of control when we start talking this way. Has this ever happened to you? Look, when you begin to clothe your thoughts with words, those thoughts become real to you. They come home to you. They ring true for you very often. They substantiate your ideas. How about that? They give them weight. Have you ever been, students studying through a page of notes, You're working through all these notes, flipping over, and you're trying so desperately to understand what it is that they're saying. But then all of a sudden you got into a study group, and you began to talk about the material with the study group and some friends, and boom, you got it. You aced that test. Oftentimes the reason is because you verbalized it. And when you verbalize it, it sort of took root in a way in which it couldn't before. Ginger and I's favorite example of this happens at rehearsal dinners. I've done over 100 weddings in my sort of pastoral career, and so one of the great benefits of that is going to rehearsal dinners. And invariably, Ginger and I do a great like party imitation of the classic a rehearsal dinner toast that we'll do for you later on. We'll come over for dinner some night. We'll do a whole like evening of a rehearsal dinner toast. But one of my all-time favorites is the groom's best friends, okay? Typically, no offense, ladies, but it's always the sorority sisters that want to come up and do the sort of like, and I just, that whole sort of deal. But invariably, when the guy gets up, it's awesome. Because for most of the time, gentlemen, and we know this, the only language we have, is this not true, is sarcasm. We're dudes. The only way we talk to each other is like, yeah, whatever, if you weren't such a blah, blah, blah. And, that's the only language we even ever talk to each other with, all right? But then all of a sudden, I'm in an environment where I kind of have to say something that's really nice. And let's say in the back of your mind, you do think of something nice. I mean, I had Christian men who had been through all kinds of rough things together suddenly get at the rehearsal dinner to share. And invariably, it would go something like this. Well, I'll tell you what, it's great to be here. And auspicious occasion, and I just tell you, I can't tell you how many times I've been through here with this guy. Well, I could tell you some stories. I won't do that to you right now. But but I tell you what, when I was a junior, I had something I went through with my family, and it was pretty hard. And I look at this guy right here, and I realize that he was, hold on. I didn't see this coming. And they suddenly come to pieces. And finally goes, I just want you, I love this guy. Boy starts to crack. Oh, we just love it at the back of us. You could just predict it. You could almost see when they were walking up that they were going to go through this whole thing. Now, here's my thing. Guys, what is happening there? Why is that happening? Why did you not see that coming? Well, the reason is because we don't understand the power of words. That there are moments where even when you begin to verbalize your love for someone, your affections for someone, those affections come home to you. They land. They take root. They embody something there, and it is, and suddenly you begin to feel emotion that you otherwise would not feel. This is one of the reasons why, let's do a little marriage counseling here for a second, it is vitally important to learn to speak the language of your spouse and to understand the manner in which they hear affection. Because the affection that you need to have to keep that bond close has got to come in terms that they can hear. And to speak words oftentimes will solve one of the problems that you feel of the waning of affection. How do we put the fire back into our marriage? Well, it might be that one of the ways is to block off 10 minutes of uninterrupted time where you simply clothe your thoughts in words, where you sort of dig for something in a day that you can be thankful for in that person. It is amazing the amount of transformation can happen in your sense of animosity with your spouse when you simply open up with thankfulness and then clothe your thoughts in words so that they sort of hear those things. Because it's not just that that will help them feel loved by you, it will help you feel love for them. Whenever I do this, introverts in the room are kind of like, I don't like words, please. I just want to stay kind of in here. And in many ways, this is the great challenge for the introvert. Now look, the extrovert's about to get it upside the head in just a second. Bear with me. Where words are many, sin is not far. The scariest verse in the Bible for me. But for introverts, it means that that's my work. That's my goal. The thing that I've got to push against my personality is the struggle to do words well. So the powerful tongue, this is sort of my big premise that I wanted to introduce you to. And now we can look then at our sort of positive and negatives as we usually do. I want to look at the destructive tongue and then finally the healing tongue as well. So God says that therefore I'm going, because of the power of these words, to have an entire command which helps you understand your words. Look, and there's a lot to protect for us in our words. Good grief. I find it interesting that when Jesus describes the devil in the New Testament, you remember what he describes the devil as? That the devil is the father of lies. The devil's the father of lies. I don't know if I would have picked that one. The devil is the father of evil, I think I would have said, or the father of death or something. But he chooses lies. Why does he do that? Well, because he has deception at his heart. So Colin Smith says that there are ways to identify what he calls stations of lying, places where we stop when it comes to lying. First of all, there are polite lies. Polite lies. Hey, Les, did you remember to pray for that thing that I asked you to pray about last week? My answer, I sure did. When the truth of the matter is, the last time I thought about it was the last time you asked me. Why? How about this? We'll get to why in just a minute. Euphemisms. You know, your writing is really coming along. When the truth is, it just stinks. It's terrible. You're not a writer. You're not good at it. word inflation, one of the things that he says. Have you ever known people to whom everything is the best or the worst or awesome? It's just awesome. Word inflation, where we suddenly throw an ocean of things out there, and after a while, what happens? You just tune them out. When words are many, Proverbs 10:19 says, transgression is not lacking. In other words, the more you talk, preacher boy, the more you cheapen what you say when you're trying to mean it, the more cheaply they get. So polite lies sort of destroy people. Number two, flattery is the second station. You know, flattery, according to Smith, is, I love this definition, saying to someone's face what you would never say about them behind their back. That's funnier than that. It'll take you a minute to get that one later on. Now, what's so bad about that? Well, because you deny that person's participation in reality when you do this. Now, look, granted, there are some of you that are actually quite good at this, and you're like, I don't mind telling somebody exactly what I think. And that's a different issue, sort of verbal brutality. But for a lot of people, in the name of politeness, some people will go through large stretches of their life without an honest understanding of who they are, because no one's given them honest feedback. Like, I just don't think you're good at this. it really is okay for you to say that this is not where you need to be. Now look, again, if I take delight in those things, that's a whole issue in itself. But the truth, oftentimes, we put people in a dependent posture when we don't give them the dignity that it takes to be honest with them. Flattery can end up demeaning them in the process and ends up trampling them, okay? Third step to lying is exaggeration. Good grief. You know, when was the last time that you sort of ever so imperceptibly embellished a particular story about yourself to sort of cast yourself in a slightly better light than you were? You know, someone asks you what happened and you frame those words in such a way to keep them from thinking that ever the blame could be all yours. A little slight embellishment. In other words, what we're doing is, oftentimes by our words, is we're managing our own PR campaign. You know, my words oftentimes are trying to make sure that you don't get a version of me that I don't want you to get. And it's destructive, right? Because it's a constant spinning. My life can be nothing but a sort of big nuance. When I was in college, this was one of the biggest, identity crises that I had. Because I ran my mouth so much, and it's always been this way, I came to a point in college where I wrestled really with who the real me was. You know, Is the real me the sort of spinning ideas that are inside my head? Or is the real me this person who's talking to people and their particular view of me is not what I want it to be? You ever had someone come up and confront you on something that you were or did or said, and you were like, in a million years, I would never have thought that I would have come across that way? In other words, the words oftentimes, when they're not sort of, when they're exaggerated or when they're sort of built up out of portion, can sort of rock us with a sense of lack of truth as well. And then finally, the destructive tongue, the last station, is the station of all-out gossip. Now, I will say this. I think that in the church, very oftentimes, there is a misunderstanding about what gossip is. Gossip, I'm going to argue, is not talking about another person. It is not gossip to simply report the fact that someone is going through a particular misfortune. Now, it may be unwise to report that fact, but that's not gossip. Gossip is when I report a fact about someone else that may be misfortunate for them, and my heart is delighting in the telling. See what I'm saying? In other words, when all of a sudden I realize that I'm so happy to pass this little piece of information along because now, in comparison with them, I look so much better. In other words, there's a comparison thing that's going on. You know, many people are overt gossips because when we confront people, we get such a charge by jumping down their throat. Look, and honestly, again, it's another marriage thing that happens. Gossip can often even happen in a marriage when sometimes we end up saying things that we don't necessarily always have to say. I used to say this in my pre-marriage counseling every time. Just because you are thinking it doesn't mean it necessarily needs to come out of your mouth. Because here's what happens. You go, well, I'm just being honest. You want to be like, you know, but what if your honesty is cruel and condescending? Because not every thought that occurs to you about your spouse is holy, just, and good. So how about, why don't we exercise the fruit of the Spirit of self-control? That sometimes if I'm going to say something that I know I'm going to regret later, I'm going to keep it in. You know, that's repression. No, it's the spiritual gift of self-control, right? Sometimes we don't need to say everything that we're thinking. Smith quotes Larry Crabb, who explains that in our culture, we have way too much emphasis on self-disclosure as the chief form of intimacy. Ooh, is the chief form of intimacy utter self-disclosure? Crabb says it's not. Sacrifice is the chief form of intimacy in the Bible sort of estimation. And it may be that one of the things that you have to sacrifice in your marriage is your partner's knowledge of every single time you have something occur to you in order for you to love them. Now look, some of you are saying this is dangerous because you're promoting, you know, my husband or my wife who keeps everything inside and everything. That's a different issue. If you're holding things from someone, then that's something you've got to work through. But it's not always the case that my role is to let the words fly, because a lot of times the words that are flying in my head are bad and bad for you. So I contain those things as a way of loving my spouse. So gossip, all of these are the steps to the destructive tongue. And look, they hurt people. There's a picture of a little boy who said about words being wrapped around his throat. All right, so fine, let's get to the good part, the healing tongue, right? Well, look, consider three things as we start to deal with bad words. The first thing I want you to think about is the Bible encourages us to find any time in which we can to force good words out of our mouths. Paul says in Ephesians 4:29, "Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up." Notice what he says, let it. In other words, control it. And if at times you need to, force good words out of your mouth, right? Why? Because encouraging words that come out of your mouth will not only encourage the people that hear those words, they'll encourage you as well. You will glean a benefit simply by finding a way to speak positive words to someone. It has a positive effect over you. I think it's one of the reasons that we ought to stop and consider that maybe the possibility is that one of the reasons why I'm hurting on the inside in the way in which I do is because only hurtful things come out of my mouth. Give me a chance to speak, and it's to complain. It's to rehearse my pain. It's to feel, it's to run someone else down. Maybe that's what's sort of causing what's going on the inside. And Paul is just saying, look, well then put a valve on it and shut it off. Shut the valve off and force good words out of your mouth. Stop and say, today, I'm going to commit myself to only bringing words that build someone up and do whatever I can. You know, the inertia, sorry, I'm going off notes here. It feels like the inertia in marriage, in parenting, in friendships, in business sort of dealings, the inertia is sort of pulling me towards this desire that if someone is not meeting my expectations, what they really need is a swift kick in the pants. Like, you're just not trying hard enough. Because the truth is, I had a married guy say this to me one time who was about to finish his marriage. I remember him saying, because this is the deal. Like, if she wanted to change, she would. Think about that for a second. If she wanted to change, she would. Really? Is that how the Bible views sanctification? I don't know. Paul in Romans 7 says that the good he wills to do, that he doesn't do. And the things that he's trying not to do, that's the stuff he keeps on doing. In other words, the Christian version is that there is a conflict. Well, I don't know. I mean, if they were really a Christian, then they would want to do these things. No, not necessarily. We are a compendium, are we not? We have both an old man and a new man warring inside of our souls. That does not tell the whole story, right? How many times, though, do we stop and ask ourselves questions about when it comes to sort of getting a different result out of this person's life? Maybe what they need is encouragement. Maybe joy might be the very thing instead of constantly having to get back to the rules. Now, I'm not an anti-rules guy. I promise you. Come to my house. You'll know I'm not an anti-rules guy. But how amazed I am how often a few words of encouragement can get somebody back in the game, so much more than, like, when I'm on the phone with a campus minister who's in a bad way. I was reading your report here. Like, what is going on? You know, what's going on in your world? Word of encouragement can be the one thing that sort of changes that around. Secondly, you've got to get honest about yourself. Joy Davidman was C.S. Lewis's wife for a brief time before her untimely death. In her essay, Fire on the Mountain, makes the point that you don't root out lying from your soul until you're honest about yourself. I think this is a huge struggle for society-type people like Christ Presbyterian Church. You know, it is oftentimes very difficult to allow our words to be an honest expression of who we really are. And I think in some degrees we've lost the art of confession. I recognize that sort of from a Roman Catholic, perhaps higher church tradition, confession still plays a very vital role in your Christian life. There are times in which you go and meet with a priest or with a holy man, and you sit and you verbalize those things that are going on inside of you that you feel ought to be confessed. But confession, in many ways, means integrity. It means wholeness. And we are fragmented people until we learn to cloak the truth of ourselves in words and give them to someone else. Why is it that James says, in James chapter 5, confess your faults to one another, finish that verse, so that you may be healed? It is healing to be honest with yourself and to actually verbalize what's going on inside. I have gotten to be a fairly ardent supporter of going to see a counselor. Because the truth of the matter is, it is not natural for us, in whatever things are going on with our day and age, to spend very directed time where you know for a fact that the person I'm speaking with is safe enough to express anything. But in that expression, in that confession, in the verbalization of what is oftentimes the boiling cauldron of stuff inside my head, you can gain some grip on your sanity. That's what going to a therapist and a counselor is about. And for lots of us, and I said us, not you, for lots of us, we need to start going. All the counselors can say thank you. You can thank me later. If there could be like a finder's fee for that, that'd be lovely. But what happens there? It's not that there's some magic that they're trying to get inside your head and figure out. The magic is in you finally, in an hour, sitting with someone and verbalizing what's going on inside of your head. That as those words come out, you begin to grasp them. You begin to understand them. You begin to make sense of them. Now look, there's a certain generation that is uncomfortable with that idea. That there was a time, even when I was a child, where the person who went to a psychiatrist, oh, they're going to a psychiatrist? Are they okay? They have problems. I mean, in other words, there's a stigma that's attached to it. And in many ways, I don't care why we've gotten, you know, sociologically less, we've gotten to this point where we need therapists and counselors because we don't have, you know, relationships among ourselves. Yes, fine, true, got it. But for many of us, when I begin to hear some of the things that are going on, I want to be like, you might ought to find somebody to talk to this about. Talk about this too. Confess your faults to one another so that you may be healed. Confess your faults. What an amazing thing that our healing may be wrapped up in getting honest with myself. Wow. Thirdly and finally, I'll finish this. We got lots of time for questions today. We got to get to the heart of our lying. Look, the truth is what comes out of your mouth is a direct result of what is in your heart. That's what Matthew 12 is saying. Jesus is saying out of the overflow of the heart, the tongue speaks. You are getting from me what is the overflow of my heart. And unless, therefore, there is a change in my heart, then we cannot hope to become someone who speaks the truth. This is such a big deal, y'all. It's got to begin in the heart here. Look, think about the prayer illustration. You know, hey, Les, did you remember to pray for that that thing that I told you to pray about? Sure, I most certainly did. I lie to put myself in a better, more spiritual light so that y'all will look at me sort of better in that sense. Now, why did I lie about that? It's possible I could spend, this is very important, I could spend the next, what, week, month, however long, you know, I remembered it, to confess that lying. Oh, I'm a liar. Les is right. Sunday school was so convicting to me. Lord, please, 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 please help me not be a liar. I don't want to lie. I'm tired of lying. It's bad that I lie. I should not be a liar. Please, Lord, will you please just take this lying away? Isn't that how we want him to do it? Snap your fingers. I want to go to bed one night, and I want to wake up in the morning a truthful person. Because your Holy Spirit eventually will do that, right? Isn't that how God works? No. No, that's not working. And I would argue it doesn't work for any of the Ten Commandments. We don't overcome sin by simply confessing the sin. What we look at is what is it that is churning that sin out? Well, it doesn't take me long to sort of figure that out. I want for you, when I lie to you about whether or not I prayed, I mean, how twisted is that? When I lie to you, it's because I want you to think that I'm a minister. Yeah. Isn't this your vocation? Isn't that what you do? Yes, you're exactly right. And I don't want you seeing that shameful part in me. So what's going on? It's insecurity. It's fear on the inside that I don't want you to see who I really am. And so what am I confessing? What am I praying for God? Am I praying, don't make me a liar, don't make me a liar? Or am I praying, God, give me a security. Give me a confidence that is so real and so tangible from you and your definition of who I am that it begins to erode my lying from the root out. In other words, don't be so superficial to sort of knock at the thing without going to the root and saying, the reason why I'm lying is because I'm afraid that if you saw me, you wouldn't love me. But you know what, God? You see me from the bottom to the top. My sin has never surprised you, neither has my lying. So therefore, coming to you, I've got to come to you in great joy and know that you are the great God who comes to heal our words. You know, on the day of Pentecost, right? There was a great healing of words as men and women began to speak in languages that they didn't grow up learning. Acts chapter 2, the Spirit comes through, and suddenly everybody begins to talk about the gospel in a language that they didn't grow up learning. It was a miracle, right? Look, when the Spirit comes, He captures the heart. And what He does is He sets up a place of joy and security in the fear and self-doubt that's normally there. And when He does that, finally we see the reason for what we get in Romans chapter 10 when Paul says that faith comes from what? hearing. Faith comes through hearing. And what does hearing come from? Hearing by the word of Christ. In other words, one of the things that we are doing when we're gathering here Sunday in and Sunday out to hear the word is to hear those beautiful words, wonderful words, wonderful words of life. Anybody ever sing this when you were growing up in church? I love that song. Beautiful words, wonderful words, wonderful words of life that come to us, that are being pronounced to us, that hopefully are beginning to erode what's inside of me. Look, and so it just means that transformation of bad tongues will not necessarily happen because I'm working at controlling my tongue, but it comes at being able to work at what's going on inside my heart. That's a Christian version of that. So, every time you get a good word preached at you, it's supposed to deal with that. All right, so, the first time in 10 lessons that I finished with early. We've got lots of time here. Any thoughts or questions? And we can sort of include all the last few versions as well, Cal. Yeah, that's a great sort of idea. And everybody always brings up the classic Corrie ten Boom. Corrie ten Boom was a Jewish lady living in Germany during the time of World War II. What did I say?
Christian.
She was a Christian woman. Sorry. But they were hiding Jewish people in their home. Sorry, that's what I meant to say. They were hiding Jewish people in their home. And so when the Nazis would come up and knock on the door and say, "Are you hiding Jews in your house?" she would lie and say, no. I've heard different people take swings at this, and I'm just going to give you the answers that I've heard. I struggle with the sort of answer to the question. This is my way of saying I really don't know exactly how I feel about those individual experiences. I do feel that there's something very intuitive about the Corrie ten Boom situation that I want to say it would be weird for someone to try to fight against that. And that's just a pure instinctive answer. I've heard someone say, this is one answer I had a guy teach a lesson on one time, that there is never a time in which I am required to say anything. In other words, there was a third option for Corrie ten Boom, that either, you know, we mostly think, either she lies and saves the Jewish people that she's hiding, or she tells the truth and costs them their life. This guy was saying, no, there was a third option. And the third option was that you say nothing. Now, of course, I had enough wherewithal at that point to ask, okay, but what if the circumstance is such that saying nothing is the same as giving them up? You know, it's really not that clean. Although I think that's part of the question. We don't always find ourselves with Nazis at our doors, I don't think. There may be a time in which it's best for me simply when I feel torn between saying the truth and hurting someone that doesn't deserve to be hurted. I speak for a living. Or, you know, lying and not that. There may be an option where I don't need to say anything, right? This is what Bambi said, and if you can't say something nice, then say nothing. Bambi? That wasn't in Bambi. Where did I get that? Is that a Disney thing? Ugly Duckling. If you can't say something nice, say nothing. Don't remember this thing? Let's all sing it together this morning. I'm kidding. Don't do that. Okay, so that's the first one, is we don't always have to speak. The second thing that I heard one time, and this was from none other than R.C. Sproul, and the entire audience was just kind of like, was actually saying that when, the biblical example is Rahab hiding the Israeli spies in Jericho? Jericho, okay? Rahab lies to the soldiers as they come around looking for these spies. Does God bless Rahab's liar? Does he not? Well, pretty clearly, you know, the narrative is lending yourself to yes, God blesses that sort of experience. But what R.C. said was, he said, yes, but because those people are pagans and there to destroy the work of God, they did not deserve the truth. And the whole crowd went, just like you just did. Is it my job to be deciding who does and does not deserve the truth? Look, I don't very easily disagree with R.C. because he's a big brain and done a lot of study and work on that. I'm just saying there's a lot of ambiguity wrapped up in some of those situational ethical questions. But I'm going to tell you my first instinct is that righteousness in that moment, I'm not sure is as unclear as we might think that it is. Like, it was appropriate for Corrie Ten Boom to save the lives of those people. That's not satisfying, is it, Cal? Be honest. You could shoot me straight. Somebody else wants to do better at that. Yeah, Rob's going to fix it right here. Go ahead. Yep.
An interesting follow-on to the Corrie Ten Boom story is that her sister was also hiding Jews, and they had a root cellar under the dining room table.
You're right. Yeah.
And there were Jews in it when the Gestapo or whoever it was came.
Yeah. That's right.
They looked and they got angry and don't make fun of us.
Right. I can't tell that illustration. I can't. I can't do it. Let's face it. Like, and you may be asking for this reason. Like, there's a theoretical question about being like, oh, this powerful thing to the truth. I think that there are some times in which it ought to be very obvious, intuitive, that truth-telling in certain circumstances that obviously got people in a lie, that would get people in trouble, is acceptable. But I'll say this, for the day-in, day-out sort of experiences that we have, I would be careful in my heart to be like, that's a great instinct, so that if I can tell the truth, you know, in such a way that's like, well, it's not a lie, you know, sort of deal, I need to check my heart on that as well. But yeah, that's right. I guess she dealt with her conscience in that particular way. That's a great question. Yeah, follow up. She's in the list in the Hebrews 11. Yeah, that's exactly right. So, yeah, good.
I can't put my finger on it right now, but isn't there one or two examples where a prophet was told to lie to
Of course there is, Errol. I just have to think of it right now. I went to seminary. That's exactly right. I mean, there's no doubt that the prophets were asked to sort of portray. Hunt that down. That sounds like more than a little familiar to me. That kind of rolls you up. But then again, you know, the prophets were also told to marry prostitutes as well. Some of those prophetic actions that are taken are often Hosea. Hosea was told to marry a prostitute, just in case you're wondering. So yeah, that one's a good question. Somebody else had their hand up, right? Greg.
Yeah, so it's a little different track here. I've often been puzzled by something I've seen in that particular commandment, because the wording is, shall not bear false witness against your neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got kind of a legal context.
Hmm.
It could have been written very broadly, just said, tell the truth.
Right.
But it's worded as if it's almost as if it's this laser focus on you're in a courtroom kind of situation. Do not say something that is untrue that is going to change the outcome of this hearing.
Mm-hmm.
I've often wondered why it uses such narrow language.
Sure. Yeah. There's no doubt the language was definitely, we know from Hebrew sources that it was directed at that very sort of circumstance. But that may be a window into why it's not quite as broad as, you know, always say what is absolutely true at all times. Yeah, that works for me. I like that one best. Yeah, Clay.
What comes to my mind when I hear you give this lesson is how often I make excuses for mistakes that I make. And I think if we practice, if you listen for excuses, our culture is just one big excuse. Just be good practice. Don't make excuses.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no doubt that it's sort of trying to find a way out of the image management. Maintaining sort of one of the things that's also a little bit weird is depending on how you were raised, oftentimes I think in the South, one of the reasons why you showed up in church in the first place was so that no one would ask you about your life. Like, our very presence here is a statement to the world, well, of course everything's going fine in church every Sunday. In other words, it becomes sort of a means by which we keep people away from the truth that's going on inside of our own souls. Yeah, yeah, this is a culturally acceptable thing. Yeah, right.
This isn't
going
to do good to kind of counter my reputation as a Luddite or whatever, but I think with the internet, I think we are kind of culturally kind of competing and kind of constantly showing our best side, putting our best foot forward. And I feel like it's maybe a challenge for, you know, against transparency.
Yeah. You know, I was doing a series late 2000s with RUS students, and I found a statistic that said, and you gotta understand, Facebook is not just like a thing on the internet, like it is the internet. Facebook is the largest, some crazy, like 3/4 of all internet traffic is Facebook. Like it's insane. It costs them like billions of dollars a month just to keep the servers going for Facebook. So there was a statistic that came out that said 80% of college students that were polled said that their Facebook profile was an accurate representation of who they really were. Now, that's a dated illustration because Facebook is just not what it used to be in terms of that kind of brand loyalty. But there's no doubt that like your Facebook profile became sort of a thing of fashioning the digital me, you know? That this is the version of me that I want you to get. And look at these happy, smiley children and nothing bad ever happens to me and all the pictures of the happiness that we have. And look, I mean, I'd do the exact same thing. Although there is another side of that. It depends on what sort of section of the internet you go to. Like, I was having a conversation this last week with someone about just being forever amazed at the shaming that goes on when someone sort of stumbles in life, especially on Twitter, you know, little micro blogging that goes on, just how people can just get eviscerated on Twitter. And I always remember this, I've used this illustration before, but I always remember that that article that I read back in the mid-90s, somewhere in 1995, 1996, when the internet was really kind of picking up, by Time Magazine, that was basically just heralding, like, we will finally now have utopia, democratic utopia because of the internet, because everyone has a voice. We can truly hear from everyone's voice if they just have, you know, a device that's connected to the internet. And of course, people were just heralding this as like the change. Here we are 20 years later. And it's almost like every article that comes out about the internet now is just like, ugh, everyone has a voice. Because that voice that's coming out is awful. You know, the stuff that's being repeated out there is just, it's amazing the kind of stuff that somebody will tweet. Cold-hearted, like vitriolic filth coming out of people's mouths or coming out of people's thumbs as they pound away out on their phones or something. Yeah, so it's crazy. Internet creates, if nothing else, the internet has made some of our internal issues sort of, they've brought them in a more dramatic relief. It saturated the colors of my debauchery is what it's done. Ooh, that's a good sentence. I need to write that down. Saturated the, never mind. Good, yes, what else? Any other thoughts or things? Yes, Susan. Yeah.
What's the other side of having to also be wise? If your words tap into your emotions, how are we good stewards of our sisters and brothers' emotions? That's pretty, you have to be brave to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The question is sort of about how do you sort of balance that sort of introversion, extroversion thing. I would simply open by saying the gospel will almost always be a fundamental contradiction of your existence. In other words, whatever way you have patterned out your life to work for you, the gospel is going to come and mess that stuff up. Like it's just going to. Therefore, for introversion, it's going to look and stretch you in such a place where it's going to say, it may be that my introversion is motivated by a simple desire to keep control. Like in the safety of my world here, I can keep these boundaries up of my shyness. How much of what we call shyness is nothing more than a commitment to control? That way I can keep everybody out there where no one sees that on the inside, I'm about to freak out. Oftentimes. The Bible comes in and says, it may be that the way that the gospel stretches you is it begins to work on that great fear of being known on the inside It draws near to you with the love of Christ and gives you a freedom to express yourself, and therefore learning things about yourself that you may not have known before. However, for the extrovert, for whom your thought is like, well, if I just throw enough words at it, eventually that person will understand me. Just keep talking, keep going. The Bible looks and says, you know, where words are many, transgression is not far. So there may be a time in which it's best for you to learn to be still, to learn to shut up, as it were, and to allow sort of things to think before I allow my words to sort of escape. Now, but in the nuanced sort of world of human interaction, it really does take extraordinary wisdom to know what's appropriate at what time. There's a lot of marriages that I've spoken to of people that are in rough situations where I thought, you know what? It sounds to me like the two of you are overinvested. That is, you need to give each other some space. In other words, you have placed upon your spouse the weight of being the place where I'm going to receive sanctification, like the only place. And again, I've said this before in this sort of time, the Bible nowhere lays that much weight upon your marriage. It just doesn't. Your spouse is not, in biblical categories, the one and primary place where you're supposed to be sanctified. It's not less than that. It is a wonderful place. There's a washing of the water, as with the word, like we have from Ephesians chapter 5. But the place where the Bible understands our sanctification being happening is in the church. These relationships here among us are the places where those things have the most vital expression. But on the other hand, I feel like there are tons of marriages as well that instead of saying you two need to detach from one another, that you've got to look and say, how easy is it in the warp and woof of life to suddenly do nothing more than what we call taking care of business with your spouse? John Cox is a counselor down in Jackson who talks about the four different kinds of communication. The first one I can never remember. It's more like cordial talk. The second one is news, sports, and weather, right? News, sports, and weather is just like, oh, you know, Justice Scalia, how you pronounce it, passed away this week, that kind of news, you know? The third level of communication is taking care of business. Taking care of business is, who is going to pick the kids up at soccer practice? Are you going to do that? Got it. Very good, very good. Okay, look, we've got to decide, what are we going to do this summer with vacation? Did you call that sort of thing? Did you get that thing done? Who's paying the bills? Where are we with this whole thing? Who are we going out to dinner with this next week? Now look, will you deny that you can spend years in your marriage doing nothing but taking care of business? You know? Cox says number four, level four communication, is what he calls abiding. And when you abide with someone, you sit down and you give them enough time, and you get enough time to express what it's like to be you that week or that month or whatever. And you hear that from life from their perspective. In that perspective, you walk away and it's kind of like, okay, I now see what your world is like. So oftentimes in marriages, there's a sense of having to re-engage, call a time out, get a date night for Pete's sake, and just say, tonight, in this hour here at Nukes, you know, you're going to talk about your life for half an hour, and I'm going to talk about my life for half an hour. Just with the goal of doing nothing more than being understood. Okay? That was nothing what your question was, but it yielded some fun stuff in response. Let's pray. We'll head for worship here. So, Lord Jesus, would you give us the grace of new words? And would you give us new words because you gave us new hearts? Even this morning, Lord, many of us are in desperate need of new hearts, our hearts to be renewed yet again by singing. Some of us will sing our way into joy this morning. By praying, some of us will speak to you and you'll meet us by your Spirit in that way that only you can. And many of us will hear your word proclaimed and will consider those words, and it will produce faith in us because faith comes from hearing those words. So, Father, would you do that in the next hour ahead of us? For we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.